Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Before his death, he led a national civil rights movement, was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace, and met with the President of the United States about voting rights. But where did this remarkable leader get his start? Today, the earlier days in the life of Martin Luther King Jr., as we get a look at a new play chronicling his college days. But first, in 2016, a 10-year-old boy was decapitated riding the world's tallest water slide in Kansas City, Kansas. Now, executives from the Schlitterbahn Water Park have been indicted for second-degree murder. We'll dive into the legal aspects of this tragedy and how it might impact state law. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Wyandotte County grand jury has indicted Schlitterbahn and a former operations director at the company with involuntary manslaughter, aggravated battery, and reckless endangerment of a child. A co-owner of Schlitterbahn Companies, along with a lead designer and a construction company, have also been indicted on charges of second-degree murder, aggravated endangering of a child, and aggravated battery. All this stems from the 2016 death of 10-year-old Caleb Schwab on the 17-story-tall Verrucht water slide. The grand jury alleged that company leaders failed to follow amusement park industry safety standards. The grand jury said those leaders lacked expertise in designing the ride and ignored warnings about the safety of Verrucht. Schlitterbahn said it took safety seriously, and the former operations director has pleaded not guilty. But how did this happen, and what are the merits of this case? That's our first segment here today. With us, Steve Vakrod is a reporter for The Star who's written extensively on this story. Steve, it's always good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Blaine Lassen is a professor of law at the Loyola University College of Law down in New Orleans. Blaine, it's nice to have you too.
That's my pleasure.
Steve, what's so shocking about these allegations, at least it is to me, is this sense you get that these guys had absolutely no business doing what they were doing in designing this 17-story tall water slide. What's your sense of it?
Well, the way the indictment's written, it's 47 pages long, and it's written in a style that is different than a lot of dry indictments that you tend to read. There are a lot of flourishes in there, if you will, that really try to underscore this sense that the designer and the co-owner of the park, like you said, didn't know what they were doing, they lacked the credentials to build a slide of this type, that they hurried the development and the construction of the slide so that they could meet a deadline for a television show that was going to feature the project, and that once the slide was up and running, that there were warnings voiced to the company that, you know, you guys have a problem. You guys have safety problems with this ride, and that they didn't do anything to resolve that. And then it goes further to suggest that there were injuries suffered by previous riders prior to this death in 2016, where they coached other employees to rewrite, you know, their summaries of how the accident happened, didn't turn over documents to investigators, things of that
nature. You know, this really struck me, too. There apparently were no high-level, complex engineering studies done on this ride. It was all trial and error. Is that what the indictment says?
Yes, that's what's alleged. And it's worth pointing out that the company has pushed back fairly hard on some of these claims from the indictment. They're saying, no, we are a safe company. We do care about safety. Since this happened, they've characterized it as an accident, and they reject the idea that this rises to a level of criminality.
You know, Blaine, as I said in the opening, the charges here are second-degree murder, involuntary manslaughter, aggravated battery, and reckless endangerment of a child. Do these charges strike you as the appropriate charges to bring in a case like this one?
Actually, no. In fact, when I first read the indictment, it struck me as a stunning level of prosecutorial overreach by the Attorney General.
In what sense?
Never has, for example, a designer of an allegedly defective design product been charged with a criminal homicide, much less murder. Hmm. And when you look at the mental state required for those very high levels of criminal homicide. The very facts alleged in the indictment, even if you accept them as true, don't support these charges. And I'll give you an example. Both involuntary manslaughter and second-degree murder are unintentional killings that are committed recklessly. The only difference between the two is the degree of recklessness involved under the facts. Now, when you understand the term recklessness in the criminal context, that requires a heightened degree of awareness of a risk of grave harm well beyond what we call ordinary negligence. So there are two very important features to a reckless killing. One is it's got to be highly probable, virtually inevitable. And the other is that it has to involve a grave harm, that is a risk of serious bodily injury or death. And the kinds of cases that these charges are typically reserved for are cases that involve a sociopathic level of depravity regarding indifference to the consequences of one's actions.
Hang on a second, Blaine. So why would prosecutors bring charges that are way over the top here? We're not talking about rookie lawyers here. This involves the Attorney General of the state of Kansas. His office was very much engaged here. So what do you think's going on?
We can only speculate as to why they are charging homicides in this case. We don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that there's never been a case of this type, unprecedented in all of the cases that I've looked at, where you're charging a designer. Think about that, the designer of a product with murder. And like I said, these charges are typically reserved for charges where there's a crime of violence against someone else. For example, shooting an automatic rifle in a crowded restaurant. That might be extreme indifference to human life that would justify a second-degree murder charge. Throwing large rocks off of an interstate overpass into oncoming traffic. That might justify involuntary manslaughter, which again is a reckless killing. But keep in mind, we don't put people in prison because of an ordinary lapse in care. Arguably, perhaps the builder of this slide and the operator of this slide were liable for some form of ordinary negligence, which is a civil matter. And from what I understand, they paid handsomely for that. I think they paid $20 million to the victims. But to take that event and somehow try to turn it into a criminal prosecution is really unwarranted under these facts. Now, let me just tell you about the facts that are alleged. The indictment itself contains a web of contradictions internally. They are saying that on the one hand, it was a faulty design that caused the raft to become airborne and cause this horrific accident. And in the same breath, they're saying there were a host of mechanical failures and operational lapses, such as leaking rafts and a deteriorating braking system. It could, but think about the charges with respect to the designer. The designer wouldn't have had any knowledge of any of those prior lapses, any of the prior incidents, which, by the way, are a handful of relatively minor injuries that you would see in any amusement park or water park setting. Huh. That's one of the problems with the factual basis. The prosecutor, the attorney general, he's using a handful of relatively minor incidents that are pretty normal in any amusement park setting, and he's using that as the factual basis to impute knowledge of this sociopathic depravity that's required for second-degree murder.
Blaine, hang on a second. Let me just ask Steve Vakrod here in the studio, what state agency at the county level, the state level, the national level, was checking to make sure that this ride was safe?
None.
None of the above.
So the state regulates amusement parks through the Department of Labor, and what they typically inspect for is structural integrity of an amusement park.
Are the bolts holding up the slide properly?
The concrete footings in place? You know, essentially testing, is this thing going to blow over in a 50-mile-an-hour wind? Is it going to support the weight of 200 people waiting in line?
But they don't actually get on the ride and ride it.
Right. So where there is a lack of scrutiny from regulatory agencies is whether the person gets a rider gets from point A to point B safely. And in our reporting on this incident after it happened, we even discovered that the insurance companies, which they have a financial stake, a financial interest in the performance of these rides, they examined it more from the standpoint of what we said earlier, structural integrity. And federal law does not govern these types of amusement park rides. They will inspect traveling exhibits or traveling rides, like you see at county fairs and things like
Right.
that, carnivals, but not these fixed in place rides like the one we're
Wow.
talking about.
Blaine, what do you make of that? That this notion that there was no governmental agency involved in making sure ultimately that this ride was safe?
Well, I think that that's a very important point because this is an unregulated and unlicensed industry. There are no uniform standards. And so, who knows if the state is seeking to deflect attention from its own failures to regulate this industry by bringing these charges. This goes back to your original question as to possible motivations.
Right.
But there is no requirement that one be an engineer to design a water slide. That's simply not a requirement. And the designer of a water slide is the conceptual person. In this case, he designed the slide path, and that was pretty much the extent of his involvement. The engineering is typically something that would be third-partied out, sent out for testing
Right.
through independent third parties. The ride was also, from what I understand, commissioned by a third party who essentially checked to see if the G-forces and the acceleration presented any risk of danger. So you have overlapping layers of oversight by independent third parties that said the ride was safe. In addition to that, you have 2 years of operation where you have literally thousands of successful runs. So when you measure thousands of successful runs versus literally a handful, five or six, of instances with relatively minor injuries, again, the overwhelming weight of empirical data suggests that there was not at least a design flaw, because
Right.
if there was a design flaw, it would have manifested much earlier
If you're just joining
and
us this
much more
morning,
frequently.
if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about the tragedy that occurred a couple of years ago at the Schlitterbahn company, where a 10-year-old boy died on the Varuk water slide. We're joined by Steve Vakrot from The Star, who's been covering this story. Blaine Lassen is a professor of law at the Loyola University College of Law down in New Orleans. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date if you have questions here. Steve, you've referred to this earlier in our conversation here, but one other factor you point to from the indictment is that the designers of this water slide were in a big, big rush here. Explain that to us a little bit more. What was the hurry?
There was a Travel Channel show that featured ride thrill rides of this nature, and the allegation in the indictment, and this was, and we at the Star discussed this a couple years ago in some of our initial reporting of this, is that they wanted to have this ride featured on this show. It would give them great publicity. And some of the context to this too is that, when Schlitterbahn opened its water park in KCK, the first original proposals were these vast, expansive ideas about what the water park would look like, and it would be, kind of this almost Walt Disney type theme park or water park, if you will. And what was developed was a little less than that. And the water slide, which was billed as the world's tallest water slide, maybe figured to reverse the fortunes that the park had in KCK. And certainly publicity on this Travel Channel show would presumably help that. And so the allegation in the indictment was that they really kind of hurried the timeline and the development of the construction of the slide to be able to be featured on that show, according to the producers'
There also
timelines.
was an issue, Steve, over how old the riders had to be to get on the ride to begin with. What was that about?
Right. There's a part in the indictment that says that a consultant had suggested that rider's age be limited to 16 years of age in order to ride this. And this that would probably factor in factors like weight and things like that. The indictment alleges that the slide's producers, developers then changed their, they disregarded that advice and decided that they'd do 14 years of age. And then right before the slide opened, they decided to dispense with age restrictions altogether.
Okay, let's go to some phone calls here. Spencer from Kansas City, Missouri. Spencer, you're on Up to Date. We're talking about the Baruch Water Slide over in KCK. Good morning.
Good morning. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I totally didn't expect to hear this morning. My question is basically this. It really does seem like, from what you guys have been talking about, like the charges in this case really are extreme, and are coming from, you know, the Attorney General of the state of Kansas. I guess my question is, in your reporting, Steve Autocrat, and any research that you guys have done, does the fact that, you know, the child that was unfortunately killed in this happened during a state legislator day and was the child of a state legislator that would have inspired or pushed more action? It feels like an overreaction. That feels like that's a part of the story that hasn't been talked yet.
Steve?
Well, the caller's correct. The boy who died is the son of state legislator Scott Schwab, who mm-hmm. represents the Olathe area in the Kansas House of Representatives. And the attorney general in the state of Kansas is an elected position. I have no factual basis at this point to be able to report that there are political motivations or leanings in this indictment. I just simply don't have those facts.
You know, Blaine, just to go along with our caller Spencer's point here, could it be that Schmidt was aiming high here with the kinds of charges he's leveled to leave himself room to consider a plea deal down the road?
Well, yes, that's a typical ploy by prosecutors. But given the very aggressive and over-the-top charges that were filed in this case with really little to no factual basis to support it, I'm not sure that this prosecutor is contemplating anything but taking this case to trial. And in terms of I think Spencer raises a very good point, because attorney general's offices are, by their nature, very, very political. This is a high-profile case, an emotionally charged case with a very empathetic victim. It could be that the prosecutor is thinking, you know, getting a conviction in a high-profile case like this may garner political capital. I don't know. I'm not suggesting that, but given the excessive nature of the charges, you've got to ask why. I think asking why is very important in this whole matter, because you know, these charges, if they are allowed to get to a jury, remember, all of this factual information hasn't withstood adversarial scrutiny. And we can't just assume all of these facts to be true. They haven't been subjected to cross-examination. The witnesses
Blaine, in a jury trial, you know, could a jury say, hey, second-degree murder is a little bit high, but we'll knock it down to involuntary manslaughter? Do juries have that kind of discretion?
Absolutely, because these are lesser-included offenses. Second-degree murder is a lesser-included offense of first-degree murder. But imprisoning anyone based upon the facts of this case would be an injustice, even if it's a lower level of criminal homicide, because the facts weren't there. Now, we've seen in the O.J. Simpson case that a jury is capable of anything, coming up with the most, you know, bizarre result in light of the facts presented. So this is a highly emotional case, and the jury would have to understand these very fine distinctions to know that homicide charges are not warranted. And so innocent people can actually spend a significant amount of time in jail if that were to happen. So that's why this is such an important case. And it's important for your listeners to ask why.
Steve Autocrat,
and to understand.
As you pointed out in your story, Schlitterbahn is 40 years old. It operates 5 water parks, 4 of them in Texas. Do we have any sense of Schlitterbahn's safety record elsewhere? And is Baruch sort of a singular kind of ride? Do other water parks have 17-story water slides at this point?
So in some of our reporting, we found instances of, litigation against the company related to injuries, things of that nature. That comes a little bit with the territory with amusement park operators. In terms of whether they have a slide quite like this, from my research, I would say no. And this was a this type of slide was a bit of an anomaly for what they and other water slide producers have constructed.
Yeah, you've also talked about the notion that some of the operators of the slide, the employees, have were pushed hard to change stories, withhold information. Explain that.
Yeah, with respect to these injuries that are discussed in the indictment, there were about 12 injuries that occurred the day before Caleb Schwab and two other women were injured on the last ride that Farouk ever took. And the allegation by the Attorney General's office is that, there's paperwork involved when you have injuries like that, and that when the investigation began, they were, company officials were asked for them, and not all of them were produced, and that this director of operations had allegedly told employees to revise their statements and how they were written and how they were described to the extent to or for the purpose of trying to minimize perhaps what was what other people would see when they read those reports.
Blaine, how much attention is this trial, if it does come to pass and there is a trial, how much attention is this going to get across the country, do you think, in the legal community?
A massive amount of attention, because it has the potential to set very troubling precedent from the manufacturing industry, for one. Now, all of a sudden, the manufacturer of a defective car or defectively designed car could theoretically be charged with homicide if there is a pattern of prior incidents relating to that product. So manufacturers are now being faced with the prospect of being charged criminally for what should be purely a civil matter, that is, being sued for mere negligence. There is a saying by a very famous jurist long ago that says, even a dog knows the difference between being tripped over and being kicked. And so this situation is more akin to ordinary negligence than it is to the, intentional misconduct that's required. That's why it's so, I think, not only because of the horrific nature of the accident, but the fact that these are unprecedented types of charges being brought in this, what is essentially a products liability case,
Right.
is has a lot of potential precedential value that manufacturers, amusement park operators, water slide operators are going to be following very, very carefully, and the legal scholarly community in general.
Right. Let's go back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Marilyn from Prairie Village. Marilyn, you're on Up to Date as we talk about the Schlitterbaum case. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, what I'd like to say is I think maybe it's time that manufacturers of products that can kill people are held to a higher standard than just a civil monetary fine. Like other basically crimes.
Blaine, what about that?
Well, that's fine if the manufacturers have exhibited the level of moral reprehensibility to their actions that would justify them being imprisoned personally. You can't, with corporations, all you can do is fine them to punish them criminally. But the individuals within that corporation, if they have the level of knowledge that rises to the level of depraved heart callousness, then yes. But it just simply isn't done, and it you don't see those kinds of cases, because think about it. The
Right.
designer is not going to sit down and design a product knowing it has a chance to, a significant chance to kill someone or to injure them, and then put that product into the
Right.
stream of commerce. That's why you don't see cases like this, and you haven't seen one, and one has never been brought. But anyone should be held accountable if they have the required mental state. But
let me jump back in
not
here
just
again.
a
Boy, yeah, Steve Vakrat, this water slide, why is it still standing? I thought there was talk months ago that the thing was going to get torn down.
Yeah, the company wants to tear it down. And I think most people would like to see this very visible reminder of what happened on August 7, 2016. They'd like to see it go away. They've been prohibited from doing so. There's a court order that says that the slide shall remain standing until any investigation is complete.
Because of evidence and that kind of thing that
right.
it might afford here.
Exactly. Yeah. And so one presumes that until this criminal matter is wrapped up, however it's wrapped up, the slide will probably remain standing until that point.
It's a fairly ominous symbol still sitting out there along I-70 as you drive back and forth. Going forward, Steve, how will the safety of amusement park rides be regulated in Kansas? Is that going to change?
There's been some legislation that's been passed to increase the level of scrutiny. It'll be interesting to see how that new level of inspection and scrutiny is tested in actuality.
Okay. We'll leave our conversation there, and it was a good one, too. Steve Vakrot, a reporter from The Star who's been covering this story. Steve, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Blaine Lassen, again, a professor of law at the Loyola University College of Law in New Orleans. Blaine, thank you for your expertise. I sure appreciate it.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Time for a break. When we come back here, we're going to switch topics dramatically and talk about the early life of a man named Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Friday in the show, we spoke with Kansas lawmakers about finding a politically feasible way to fund the state's public schools. You can hear that conversation in all of our previous episodes. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, we'll learn about a local push to rename the Paseo after Martin Luther King Jr. We'll also sit down with first-term mayor of Kansas City, Kansas. That's David Alvey. Join us tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, as the nation girds itself for the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., noted playwright Kevin Willmott is taking a different look at the civil rights leader. In a new production, Becoming Martin, Willmott explores the young king who ventured off to Morehouse College at the unusually young age of 15. There, he was mentored by Dr. Benjamin Mays, who gave King advice that would change his life. That advice centered on the idea that a minister can be a modern man who fights for justice and equality. That counsel changed the arc of King's life and the life of the nation. Kevin Willmott is a professor in the Media and Film Studies Department at KU. He co-wrote the forthcoming film Black Klansman with Spike Lee. The two also combined for the 2015 film Chirac. And Kevin also wrote and directed CSA, Confederate States of America, as well as Destination Planet Negro. Kevin, welcome back. So good to have you here.
Good to see you, Steve.
They call you prolific for a reason, don't they?
I guess so, man.
You're always knocking stuff off.
Trying to do it, right?
You know, you tell a story about the reaction you got from your teacher the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis. I think you were 10 years old, probably in the fifth grade. What happened?
Yeah, well, you know, my family, my mother specifically, was a news person. And so we had to watch the news every morning before we went to school. And so I was always up to, you know, up to date, no pun intended, on those events. Okay. And so that night before, you know, Dr. King had been assassinated, and it was just a huge, huge thing at my house. My mother was screaming on the front porch and crying. Mm. And just, you know, so I went to school the next day expecting to have this big conversation.
Of course.
You know, and so when I said Dr. King was assassinated last night, my teacher told me we won't be talking about that.
How did you react to that?
I was just stunned. You know, I mean, I remember just because I mean, I'd always, you know, talked, you know, spoke up in class and had contributed that way about current events, and never had a problem. And to be shut down like that, and clearly it was like a shutdown too. It was like, you know, we won't be talking about
it. We're not going there.
We're not going there. And of course, what it does to young people, you become obsessed with the thing that they won't let you talk about. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the major things that's made me talk about race ever since, really, is because when someone tells you not to do something, when your kid's like, well, that's what I'm going to do now.
I was going to say, how did it change your attitudes about who you were and who you wanted to become?
Well, I think it for me, it was really... You know, the town I grew up in, Junction City, was an incredibly diverse place. And
military town.
Military town, yeah. Army town. And it was, you know, everyone was almost biracial. I mean, everybody in my block was biracial. And so, I mean, I knew race was not important, but I knew race was also really important. And it's that conflict, that dichotomy that that really has shaped, I think, the things I write about, the way my approach to America, the way I see America.
I was going to say, race has been a theme all the way through your career and what you've produced.
No doubt about it. And when I think back about my teacher, you know, laying that one on me, I think it really does, it lets you know that this clearly was something important that she couldn't talk about. And as I went through school, I saw that kind of incident over and over again in various other ways where teachers couldn't go there. They didn't know how to talk about it. They didn't know how to speak about race. They were uncomfortable with it, various things. And so much of my work is trying to find a way to really give people the empowerment, the control of those issues.
So this new production you have going at the Coterie is about a Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. There are 8,500 entry points into his life, but you chose to pick the young Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. How come?
Well, I think that's one that has not really been explored yet, really.
Not much, really.
And to me, this little period of the play that we explore is really the significant part of what makes him Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Because he was thinking about becoming a doctor or a lawyer, right? This is sort of where he thought he was going.
Exactly. Did not want to be a minister at all. I mean, just like this is, I mean, you know, he had a very strong father, you know, and his father was a minister and his father was a minister before him. And so the idea of being a minister was just like, you know, just grounded in everything he lived with.
It was too expected.
Yeah. And so, but the thing that even as a teenager, young teenager, I mean, King understood that he wanted to be more sophisticated than what he saw within the religious circles he was growing up in. I mean, he saw religion as more complicated than what he was seeing. And it wasn't that he was against it, but he didn't really see what really spoke to him. And what spoke to him was a more modern kind of view of politics.
And be what, a consequential agent of change? Is that part of the thinking?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, his father was obviously a man who had already kind of stood up to racism, had stood up to segregation in various little minor kind of ways, you know, through his own personal interactions with segregation. And so young King knew that, you know, that was an element of his life, and he kind of learned that from his father to some degree. But the other part that he didn't connect with his father was, you know, he felt religion was just too fundamentalist. I mean, he just felt it was just too black and white, and in biblical stories that he didn't quite believe, and things that he just wanted deeper, more complicated answers to, more enriching answers, and that's where Dr. Benjamin Mays comes in.
You're taking the words out of my mouth. He meets this man named Dr. Benjamin Mays, who had this enormous impact on the young Martin Luther King Jr. Who was he? Who was Benjamin Mays?
Well, Mays is really an incredible man. I mean, he's the president of Morehouse College, but you know, in his own right, he was a minister himself, and had kind of had a, you know, amazing kind of journey. He'd gone to Bates College, you know, and he had gone to University of Chicago, and he was from South Carolina in horribly impoverished situation. One event that really shapes him is when he's 5 years old. The Klan, you know, are lynching people in the area, and they stop him and his father on the road, and they make his father bow down in the road, and really just kind of, you know, just humiliate himself
in this
situation. And he remembers, he's a little under 5 years old. He's a little, you know, he's 4 years old basically. And he sees it, and it has this big, big, big kind of effect on his life dramatically. And so he's similar to King in that sense, that he sees then religion as not just a thing to kind of appease and to kind of give you comfort in life, but also to change things and move things forward.
And that's the message he gives King, that religion can be a whole lot more than maybe what you're thinking about. And that's what wins over the young King?
That's what wins over the young King. I mean, you know, it's, you know, people call it liberation theology now, different things like that. But it was those kind of understandings that, you know, religion is not just meant to you know, be a comforting kind of agent that it's really, you know, is a
catalyst.
It's a catalyst to move things forward. And Mays, but it was also that Mays had a more sophisticated theology as well. I mean, he looked at religion in a modern context, and that modern context, you got to understand, this is late 40s, early 50s. And people are coming back from the war, and you know, everything changes in that period. I mean, theology changes, everything starts to change, and people are not kind of looking at things so black and white anymore. They're looking at the complexities of life.
Kevin Wilmot is my guest. He's a professor in the Media and Film Studies Department over at KU. We're talking about a new play he's written, Becoming Martin, exploring the early years of Martin Luther King Jr. at Morehouse College. Becoming Martin will open the Coterie's 40th anniversary season with its premiere run beginning in mid-September. More information, just go to thecoterie.org. You know, Dr. Mays saw something special in Martin Luther King Jr. when King first arrived at Morehouse. What did he see?
Well, he saw, you know, first I should probably say that because of the war, they were, they needed students at Morehouse. I mean, all the young regular male students, you know, it's a men's college, and so many of them were in the war, had been drafted, were in the war, so they needed students, and so they opened it up to younger people in high school who were advanced, and King was advanced.
He's 15 when he arrived.
He's 15 when
he's a pup. Yeah.
He's a pup. He's a little kid, really, and and so he gets there, and he's got that King vocabulary that he's, of course, very known for. He'd already really started to have that and develop that. And he's just really inquisitive. He's looking for these answers to these theological questions that he has, that his father really has kind of, you know, influenced him with.
Does he have a vision at that point, Kevin, for what he thinks America needs to become, this notion of economic injustice that he so much railed against throughout his career?
He certainly has those feelings of wanting to do something for the black community. He wants to do something for African Americans, but he doesn't really know what. He's a kid. I mean, one of the things I love about the story is that I think when we see iconic figures like King and others, we think of them almost like saints, and they are saints, but a saint is just an extraordinary human being. And the human being part of him, he was just like everybody else. He was a kid trying to figure it out.
He liked girls too.
He liked girls.
He's a real person.
He's a real person. He liked to wear tweed. You know, they called him Tweed, you know, because he liked to wear tweed, and he liked to dance. You know, he got behind the building and had his first cigarette. You know, I mean, he's a kid trying to figure it out. But at the same time, he has these skills, he has gifts, he has talents that, you know, can be taken and built upon, and he can achieve great things, and that's what's happening here.
And Mays is seeing all of that.
Mays sees all of that.
In living color, yeah. Hey, how much material is out there about this point in King's life? Did you have to search hard for it, or is there stuff out there?
There's a little stuff out there. I mean, most of his biographies, mostly biographies about King, you know, have a chapter or so about it. But there's not a lot about the conversations that Mays and King had in specifically.
So well, I bet you'd pay money to hear some of those.
Oh, man. You know, I mean, there's, you know, Mays has a lot written about him. And my colleague at KU, Dr. Randall Jelks, he wrote a book about Mays. Mm. And that was one of the things that influenced me as well. But there's a lot of things in general about their relationship. But they had these ongoing conversations after chapel, and so there would be Reverend Dr. Benjamin Mays would do a sermon, and then after that sermon, it was called chapel. After that sermon, he would come and speak to Dr. Mays after that, and have a bunch of questions for him, and wanted to get into a conversation about the philosophical, theological, political things that he was talking about, and that's where that mentorship kind of grows.
You know, this week, as you well know, we're going to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. You know, it seems to me, you know, these days you can pick any number of stats that describe the modern day plight of African Americans in this country. Here's one. Home ownership among African Americans is just over 40%. That's 30 points behind the rate for whites. You can't help but wonder what Dr. King would think of America today, exactly 50 years after his death.
Well, you know, I think he would see how, you know, just in my opinion, but he would see how much we've advanced, and there's been a great advancement in so many areas. And then he would see how things have not just not advanced, but how things have even declined.
The economic injustice that was so important to him at the end of his life, still such a searing issue today.
That is the big one.
Oh,
that is the big one. And you know, some people argue that maybe he was even assassinated because of that. Of that issue, because he's starting to get into those economic issues when he's assassinated, and that's, you know, when it comes to money in America, that's where the conflict really starts, and when you start to talk about equality with money, because money is just woven into the issue of equality, it's just woven into it, and you can't really separate it, and so that's where the big boulders are hard to move.
You know, there's this new move in this country, relatively new move, even in the Deep South, to take down monuments to Confederate war generals. New discussions about how we commemorate symbols in our society today. What do you make of it, and what do you think Dr. King would make of it?
I would have to believe that he would be. This would be a huge step forward, for, you know, in terms of the American memory. I mean, you know, how America sees itself has so much to do with these economic issues we were just talking about. How America sees itself in terms of equality, in terms of bringing everyone into the American family, and those monuments are just totally anti-America. They are the other America. They're the CSA, not the USA.
You know, you just completed yet another project with Spike Lee. This one is the forthcoming film, Black Klansman. How did you first connect with Spike Lee?
It was really through my film, CSA.
CSA.
And when he heard about the film and he was really interested in it, and we had the same agent at the time, and when he got to see the film, he really loved it, and he presents that film. It's presented by Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asked me, and I always tell my students, you know, he asked me, well, what do you have any other scripts? And so
as a matter of fact, Mr. Lee. Yeah. Let me just kick one out this weekend. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I had the script that turned into Chi-Raq. And so we've really kind of been a working had a working relationship really ever since.
Black Klansman, your new production. What's that about?
That's about Ron Stallworth. He was the first black policeman in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And this is early 1970s, and he, you know, he's just a young guy, real young guy, and he's like 18, 19, and they bring him in, they put him in charge of kind of observing all the radical groups in Colorado Springs, and you know, this is 70s, so there's all kind of radical groups, and so one of the things he sees is that there's an ad for the Klan in the newspaper. The Klan is looking for people to join. And so he's so young and inexperienced, he's such a rookie, he calls the number and actually uses his real name, Ron Stallworth. And the Klan falls in love with him over the phone. They want him to join. And, of course, he can't join because he's black. And so they have to get a white policeman to play Ron Stallworth and infiltrate the Klan. But he continues to have this ongoing relationship over the phone with the Klan. And so,
wait, was he sympathetic with the Klan?
No.
He's just infiltrating.
He's infiltrating it.
Yeah.
And so they infiltrate the Klan, him over the phone, and a white policeman playing him in real life.
That's quite. How'd you come across that story?
There was a book called that Ron Stallworth wrote called Black Klansman, and Jordan Peele, the Get Out. He's the producer of the film, so he brought us in to Spike and I to rewrite it and Spike to direct it.
Well, you're really orbiting in some pretty high circles here, Buster. I mean, this is pretty cool.
Well, it's
Jordan Peele, Spike Lee, and this is amazing.
Well, the thing I tell my students is that, you know, I always just concentrated on what I wanted to really the stories I wanted to tell.
And let the rest fall where it
was. And I don't even have an agent right now. And so, and it's these things just come to you because of the efforts you make on your own and the stories that you kind of become known for.
What's it like working with Jordan Peele and Spike Lee? What kind of relationship do you have with Spike?
Oh, it's been really great. I mean, Spike has given me great opportunities, and I have to say we're friends. And
have you sat courtside at a Knicks game with him yet?
I have not. I've sat courtside. I've sat, with I guess you call it courtside or whatever, with at a Yankees game with him.
Oh, okay,
most of my time is still spent out this way. Mm-hmm. And one of the great things about the world we live in now is we communicate through email, and I send my pages to him, and he sends his pages to me, and we work like that.
Are you pretty good about going back and forth, saying this works, this doesn't work, and is it relationship easy that way?
Yeah, very easy. I mean, I think we're both about the same age. We have the same kind of point of view on most things, and we both went to NYU, so we have a lot of kind of things in common.
What do you think, there's always been these questions about in Hollywood about the market for quote-unquote black films. How about the market for a film like Black Klansman that you just described to us?
Well, the great thing...
It sounds great to me.
Yeah, well, the great thing about what's just happened with Black Panther, you know, is that...
It's opened a door?
It's just changed everything. I mean,
wow,
that whole notion about how black films don't sell overseas, that's been one that I've been hearing ever since I've been in the industry. I mean, they kind of use that like a club against your head.
And now it's certifiably not true.
It's certifiably not true. And we always knew it wasn't true, but one of the problems has always been the effort people, that distributors make in trying to sell the film overseas. And it's a little harder to sell in certain ways. You've got to try a little harder. You got to put a little more effort into it. And most distributors are kind of lazy.
yeah. Well, Kevin Wilmot, again, a professor of media and film studies over at KU. His new project, Becoming Martin. It opens up this fall at the Coterie to open up the Coterie's 40th anniversary season. And we can look for Black Klansman. When can we look for it?
It's probably going to be out this fall or this summer.
It's exciting.
Yeah, it's
a lot of good stuff going on.
A lot of good stuff.
Always great to have you here.
Thank you.
Kevin Wilmot, again. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, we sit down with the mayor of Kansas City, Kansas. That's David Alvey. And we'll hear what his priorities are for his first year in office. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.